Yeah, just go for it.
Okay. On this episode of What's What? Hinduism, part one of our series on Eastern philosophy and religion.
Perfect.
Okay.
We're going to go right into the episode, so
okay.
It's all right. So you're going to have to switch from your announcer voice into your casual.
Should I do it again?
No. We'll just go right into it.
Okay.
It's all good.
You got all right.
It. Yeah. What's up, Bruce?
Hey.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
So I'm very lucky to have you for this episode because of your Indian lineage and heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to speak about these things with any authority or knowledge.
Well, I don't know. Our next episodes in this series are going to be on Buddhism and Zen and Taoist philosophy. So this one, yeah, I guess is kind of near and dear. And like Hinduism is obviously something I grew up with and never really understood. Still don't totally understand. But we're going to kind of dive into it a little bit about the history and maybe what you've picked up as somebody who's not a Hindu,
mm-hmm.
your observations.
Would you call yourself a Hindu culturally?
Yes, I guess. Yeah, it's the main religion that I grew up with in my house. And we definitely, you know, did the celebrations for Hindu celebrations. And yeah, it was the main thing I grew up with. I'm not really anything else.
Yeah.
Am I practicing? Not really.
Maybe an atheist, like Hindu atheist.
Yeah. I mean, I had a kind of revelation as a child that like I didn't want to go to the temple anymore and that I wanted to be an atheist. But as I've gotten older, I think the spiritual aspects of Hinduism have kind of made more sense to me. And my view of it has become less, like, I guess, I think it's less dogmatic than I once thought. And it's kind of open to interpretation.
Well, that is the interesting thing about Hinduism, is that when people say Hinduism, what they're referring to is not necessarily one centralized religion. They're really referring to a very broad lifestyle, different religions within a religion, different practices, different stories. Like you talked about, narrative is very important.
And
in
like
Indian
regionally
tradition.
Within India, different gods are worshipped more.
Right,
also within
right.
different communities, different deities are more revered. So yeah, I don't think, and then also in Bali, where we are, obviously there's a whole different form of Hinduism that is practiced here quite quite religiously.
It's very unique to Bali. It's Balinese Hinduism.
Yes.
So let's take a big step back then for people that, because I was one of these people not that long ago, for people that don't really know what we mean when we say Hinduism. So it comes from the Indus Valley. Indus Valley civilization, which is in between modern day Pakistan and India, Northwest India.
Yeah.
So you want to give people just a little,
well, history?
A little history recap?
I guess, I mean, I was reading about it today, but Hinduism is probably one of the oldest religions in the world. And so the kind of dating back or like some of the first texts were written like 4,000, 3,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the Indus Valley civilization kind of established itself 1,500 BC. And that was the first time that Hindu scriptures were written down in Sanskrit. So I guess Hindu comes from Indus, and you said India also comes from Indus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all referring to this civilization of what are known as Indo-Aryans. And if you go back on our last episode, or on a few episodes ago, when we spoke about food of the gods and kind of this melting pot of what was going on during this time, you can say, yeah, the Indo-Aryans came down from like Persia. They were on horseback. They had the wheel already invented. And they kind of came through and dominated a lot of those nomadic communities that were in that area.
In the Indus Valley.
In the Indus Valley.
Hmm.
So Indus Valley is kind of credited for being one of the first like civilizations. But it's also really a period in time when specialization was starting to occur, where they kind of realized the way to run a civilization was to stratify the people, the community. So also very tied in with Hinduism, especially around this period, is the caste system, which has now obviously affected India pretty much until now.
Which is related, like we were talking about earlier, to their idea of dharma, which we can talk about later on. But yeah, go ahead if you want to give people some more history.
No, but I mean, I guess the principal kind of concepts within Hinduism would be of the Brahman and the Atman. and obviously the sound Om. I think this Om sound is like, everyone kind of knows it, but it is, it's kind of known as the primordial sound.
Mm-hmm.
It was the sound that created all the other sounds in the universe. And it was said to have originated from the drum of Shiva.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. So,
well, maybe this is a good time to talk. So you brought up Shiva. So there's three main deities that, well, I mean, like you said, there are a bunch of different ones, but the three ones that people are probably familiar with, Shiva, and Shiva is kind of the god of destruction.
Destruction, yeah.
Right? And then you've got Vishnu, the god of creation.
Preserver.
Right. Maintaining. And then you've got, what's the third one?
Brahma.
And then that's Brahma, the god of creation.
Right. So that, another way to kind of look at that is the sort of cycle of life. So there's like birth, and then there's maintenance, and then there's death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the symbolism that these three gods kind of show is that those three parts of life are completely natural.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you need to have destruction in order to have creation.
Right.
So very closely tied to the concept of Shiva is Shakti. So each one of those gods has a female counterpart. So I got them here. So Brahma has Saraswati. So she's like the goddess of education and like learning, which also kind of ties together with creation.
Mm-hmm.
Lakshmi is kind of the god of good fortune and wishes, and she is the counterpart of Vishnu. And then Parvati, also known as Durga or Kali in another form, is the counterpart of Shiva. And she specifically, so Shakti, Durga, or Kali, is the goddess of like creation and kind of like the creation before the void. So I've read this really interesting book about Kali, which kind of describes her. Kali means black. It also means time. So it's this pre-Big Bang kind of, and it was the female birth energy that put the Big Bang into creation.
And Kali is also associated with death and violence sometimes too, and sexuality as well, right?
I think misunderstood because she's depicted in such a scary form.
Mm-hmm.
But like, for example, she's got a garland of heads and like a big scary tongue. But the garland of heads is actually supposed to symbolize ego, death of ego.
Oh, okay.
So that's why she's actually the one who's killed Shiva. And so it's kind of this female power. It's a divine feminine force.
So Kali kills the god of destruction. Shiva, she
one-ups him, basically, because she's pre-time. She's the void of destruction.
Hmm. Interesting.
The vacuum.
Okay.
In which things can be created, like the womb, you know, this
concept.
So Shiva is kind of one of the main gods in Hinduism, and this destructive force is really revered and worshipped. And often you'll see in Hindu temples a kind of like little phallic statue, which is called the Shiv Lingam, and it's literally supposed to depict a penis. And then around it, very often, you have a yoni, which is the female form.
Hmm.
And these two things go very much together, the same way that black and white and yin and yang kind of. So Shiva's like a very forceful thing, and then we kind of describe the Shakti as a very vacuous thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this same kind of energy forces that we play with through the universe.
And I think that's what resonates so strongly with me personally. I think a lot of Western people that are disillusioned, or I wasn't even disillusioned with Christianity because I was never part of it, but just never really resonated with me. But then I see Hinduism, I learn about Hinduism and Buddhism and this idea that it's all part of it.
Yeah.
You know, death, destruction, creation. You know, we tend to think it's a bad, quote unquote, bad thing. But in reality, like you said,
mm-hmm.
the good things, the positive, the creation can't exist without the destruction. And that's what I love so much about learning about Hinduism,
mm-hmm.
is that that's just so central to everything that they believe. And there's this acceptance mm-hmm. of that. And you feel that really strongly here in Bali, right? Like that's what I love about living here, is you kind of pick up on these things just by osmosis. I'm not Hindu, but living here, it's just like, well, you're kind of part of the culture, whether you like it or not. Like you live here for long enough, it just kind of seeps into you.
Yeah.
And you just accept, like the level of acceptance that I have since I've lived here is just, I've never accepted things so much mm-hmm. as I have now. Mm-hmm. And I definitely credit being around so many Hindus you know, for that, because there is this in Bali, you know how people are here. They just kind of, they're like, yeah, that's just what it is.
That's just how it is. That's
just how it is. Well, it's neither good nor bad.
Western religion, I think Alan Watts kind of describes it. He says that in Western religion, like God is always depicted as a carpenter or a potter, and they're the ones who make the world around them.
Right.
Whereas in Eastern philosophy, the universe is depicted much more as like an organism or a play or a drama going on all around you, and you're just kind of one of the actors in it. So it's a much more like lighthearted view of the world going on around you, rather than this like we've got to control and we have the control over how we should act and what we should do.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I read this little passage from, this is from World History Encyclopedia, and it's this, just this article about Hinduism, but I liked it. I think that it gets to one of the core elements here. So this is reading from this article, or this page about Hinduism. It says, the purpose of life is to recognize the essential oneness of existence, the higher aspect of the individual self known as the Atman, which is part of everyone else's self as well as the over soul slash mind. And through adherence to one's duty in life, that's the dharma that we talked about, performed with the proper action, karma being the proper action, to slip the bonds of physical existence and escape from the cycle of death, a rebirth and death, that's samsara. Once the individual has done so, the Atman joins the Brahman and one has returned home to the primordial oneness.
Yeah.
And then that which keeps one from realizing this oneness is the illusion of duality, the belief that one is separate from others and from one's creator. But this misconception, known as Maya, encouraged by one's experience in the physical world, may be overcome by recognizing the essential unity of all existence, how alike one is to others, and finally to the divine, and attaining the enlightened state of self-actualization. I think that pretty well captures
that really sums it up nicely. It kind of also touches a little bit on that concept of Brahman and Atman. Mm-hmm. So Atman being the universal soul. So we have our individual souls, but the purpose is to actually realize that we are all part of one soul.
Mm-hmm.
And then Brahman is a like a metaphysical concept which unifies the whole universe and all the things going on in the universe. And Brahman is kind of untouched, like it's unreachable for humans, because we have ego and we have the illusion of reality and we have all these kind of things obscuring us from reaching that point. So the Brahman, that's the point, right? So we're in this cycle of reincarnation. Another like main tenet of Hinduism is that your actions of your past life and your actions of this life, your karma accumulates and will then kind of, it doesn't really decide how your life will play out, but it gives you an opportunity to shed some of it. That's what each iteration is, just giving you an opportunity to shed some of that karma that you've accumulated and then eventually reach enlightenment, moksha, which is this Atman meeting the Brahman point.
Where you're liberated from this physical existence and all the limitations.
Cycles of reincarnation that you're going through. But whether or not that's a feasible thing, whether or not that's what most Hindus strive for, I think is really debatable. I don't think, it was always the Brahmins, which are the highest caste, that would be the ones who would be able to study and meditate and do the prayers and the rituals in order to reach that state.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily meant for everyone. And I would say Hinduism, the way that it's practiced in India on a daily general form, is very much still like kind of, in Bali, it's very much a gratefulness exercise. I think we see people here putting out their offerings like every couple hours, almost a few times a day. And this practice is like a gratefulness moment, I think. Whereas in India, I find that it's a much more like wishing for something. So you pray, you know, you pray to God for good fortune. You pray to God for something like that. I wouldn't say most people go to the temple in India to reach enlightenment.
Hmm. Okay. So I want to get back, because what we were talking about with the Brahman,
mm-hmm.
Alan Watts had something pretty interesting to say that was related. You want to hear that? I think it's a good time, because you were definitely
It's a very difficult concept to explain, and I think he does a really good job
of
explaining it.
Exactly your point, that it's almost unexplainable.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, let's hear what he has to say, because you're right. I think he nails it as usual.
The whole point of the Brahman idea is missed. When you form any image of it in your mind at all, even jello, even empty space or boundless light, Brahman is what we ourselves really are, what this whole universe is fundamentally and actually. There is no way of thinking about, of imagining that. For the very simple reason that as water cannot rise higher than its own level, thought cannot think what is higher than thinking. It cannot conceive the mind which thinks, and still less the power which generates the mind.
So I like that, because he's doing what he does best, which is explaining things that he admits cannot be explained.
Mm-hmm.
And by explaining it that way, you kind of, for me at least, I get it, at least as much as we're is capable of getting it, not understanding it in an intellectual way, but just feeling it like, oh, that makes sense to some like part of my being.
Yeah.
That there's something out there that is beyond our reasoning.
And I think when you meditate, and I think when you spend those moments to kind of tap in, is when you feel it the most, or when you're maybe out in nature.
Mm-hmm. Because that's the whole idea, right? Like, we're getting back to the practices that, I mean, let's just stick with Bali as an example, the Balinese Hindus, and what they do every morning. There's the chanangsaris, the offerings,
mm-hmm.
and they also do the sweeping, right? Yeah. Which is a meditative kind of clearing, and it's this way. I mean, well, maybe you can
speak
to that a little more.
So there's many steps. So yeah, first you sweep, because it's kind of clearing out the energy, clearing out the juju. And then the first thing that they actually do is they'll drop a few drops of alcohol on the floor. So they kind of have those little shaking bottles,
mm-hmm. yep,
and
yep.
a few drops of rice wine will go to the floor. And that's meant for the low level spirits. And then they will put an offering on the floor. The offerings that go on the floor, you might see cigarettes, you might see coffee in them,
mm-hmm.
You'll see the biscuits and candy, and they're again kind of like the vices that are meant to appease the lower spirits. And then they'll always put an offering higher up, usually higher above their head, and that one's for the upper spirits. So there is this aspect of duality. And then there's also a blessing that they do. They first have to purify themselves with the incense smoke. Flowers are used in that ritual. But you're basically giving gratitude, and you're giving gifts to the good and the bad parts mm-hmm. of life.
And again, we come back to this acknowledgement, this acceptance that they have, that it's all part of it.
Mm-hmm.
This eternal struggle that we seem to be caught in.
The duality of life.
Yeah, we make it so much harder on ourselves when we create division, instead of just saying, well, we're all part of it. At some point in this cycle of samsara,
mm-hmm.
where our souls, individual or collective, is going to be on one end of this or another. It may, you know, we may be on one side in this life, but we will certainly experience the other side in the next iteration or the iteration before. So yeah, I mean, I love that so much. And I think that that's why we're talking about it in the show, because mm-hmm. it relates to, again, like these themes that we want to explore ourselves, we want to help ourselves with, and also share with people, which is, how do you live a more fulfilled life? How do you feel better about being in this human body, feeling kind of stuck, as I think a lot of us do sometimes. So, well, where do you want to go from here?
I think it'd be maybe cool to touch a bit on that story in the Bhagavad Gita, and kind of
mm-hmm.
touch a little bit more on some of the main stories and kind of maybe tie them back to what we've been talking to, because the Bhagavad Gita, which is like pretty much one of the main stories, myths in Indian philosophy or Indian scripture, is this battle between Prince Arjuna, his chariot rider, Krishna. Krishna is, I believe, an iteration of Vishnu, if I'm not wrong. And
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
And then
which is also your last name.
Which is my surname, yeah. They've got to go into battle with some of their family members. I think it's like their uncles or their cousins or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Arjuna is like on the battlefield, and he's talking to Krishna. And he's like, look, I really don't want to fight my family. Like, I don't want to do this. But Krishna basically says that, look, you're a prince. Like, you are the head of this army. It is your dharma and your purpose to do this. So then in the end, they go into battle, and obviously they win. And but the kind of point, this conversation that's had in the Bhagavad Gita is kind of learned all over India as this conversation of sometimes you have to do things that you don't like. Sometimes there is suffering in life. But knowing your duty, your dharma, your purpose is really a key point.
And being true to that.
And being true to that. And through doing that, even if you're not necessarily doing a good thing, your karma is still going to get, I guess, lowered if you follow your true purpose.
Hmm. Yeah, I was listening before we started the episode. I was listening to Watts, and from that show that we just played a clip from. He's talking about the Bhagavad Gita. And he's talking about this conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. Arjuna, and saying that, well, if you do an evil thing for reasons that are associated with your dharma, it kind of ceases to be evil. But then if you do what you think is the right thing or the good thing by not fighting, but you're not doing it you're not aligned with your dharma, your purpose in this life, then actually it's not a good thing. I don't know if I'm explaining that very well, but you get what I'm saying, right? That even fighting and killing sometimes, if that's part of your dharma, your purpose, your duty in this life, then actually it's the noble thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And ignoring that is not the noble thing to do, which is interesting and kind of...
I feel like it mirrors like kind of this internal conflict that humans go through just generally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there are some times where you feel like, oh, I need to fight for this. I need to be aggressive. I need to stake my claim. I need to do something that may not be morally right, but it feels right to you for some reason, even though the standards of society may not agree with that. But for some reason, you feel compelled to do it. And what Alan Watts was saying when he was talking about this story is that if it comes from fear, then it's always the wrong thing to do. Wrong.
Interesting.
Saying wrong in quotes, but not the noble thing to do, not in keeping with your dharma. Because if you're truly living your purpose and doing your duty, dharma, then it's not going to be coming from a place of fear, regardless of what it is. And that's what he was saying to Arjuna, was that, you don't want to fight because you're afraid. And that's not a good reason to not fight.
Mm-hmm.
If you had an objection to fighting because you didn't feel like that was your role in this world, then okay, that's fine. But like you were saying, Krishna said to Arjuna that, no, this is your role.
Yeah.
This is your dharma. This is what you do. And that, getting to what you're saying, that's a tough one to accept. It's like we have certain roles and responsibilities in this world.
I mean, you got to also remember the context in which this was written. So this was written in like a period of where they're trying to make the first civilization work, you know, and they kind of have to create these stories to get people to sort of follow.
Yeah. That's an important part of it, because this relates to what you were talking about earlier, which is the caste system in India that evolved from this idea of dharma.
Yeah.
Saying there are four different classes of people. There are the warrior class.
The priests,
the warriors, the merchants, and the laborers.
Yeah.
I don't know the Sanskrit names for them, but you're absolutely right that in order to have a functioning society, you have to get people to get on board with certain ideas and stories. And that's a powerful way to do it, is by telling them a story and making them believe.
So I don't know necessarily if that exact tenet really applies.
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
It's a tricky one.
It is a tricky one. But if you think about it, okay, we all have to live in some kind of community or society. And with that comes some roles and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. If you look at Western civilization and society, I think, and we may have a little bit of a disagreement about this, but I think one of the problems for our generation, my generation, your generation, is that we've rejected so many of those roles and responsibilities. Mm. And you're kind of the same way that, you know, we grew up in similar ways. You grew up in Singapore and Hong Kong, and you were empowered like I was. We kind of lived in more individualistic societies that said, well, pursue whatever it is that you want to pursue.
Yeah.
Regardless of what you feel you were born into, you have choices.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, that's accurate to say, right?
But that's actually pretty a recent phenomenon, if you think about it.
It is recent. Yeah. And that's what I mean. I don't know if that's necessarily a positive thing, because this relates to a lot of what's happening in places like America right now and in Europe to a certain extent, where people are rejecting even their most basic biology in some cases and saying, no, I can't be tied down by anything. And it's like, oof, that's a tricky one. That's definitely a slippery slope. Now, there's two sides of that spectrum, which is, oh, no, you're completely tied down. You're stuck in your caste. You're stuck in your
you're never going to progress up or down. Yeah.
Right. And then there's the other side of which is, no, I'm not restricted by anything. So I guess it's about finding some middle ground there and saying, yeah, I am an individual. And
I guess if you're also indoctrinated to accept your position in life, then you wouldn't feel such a conflict in wanting to move up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Know? But our society has maybe taken away that acceptance of where you are.
Yep.
And kind of changed the doctrine to we need progress.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what's causing us to, I don't know, reject. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, but it also relates directly to the idea of karma, which is, well, what choices do you really have in this life? And I like the way that you put it, that each life, each iteration gives you a chance to shed some of these things. Or as Hubert put it, I think Hubert said offloading.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way that he put it. And I thought that that was really interesting. That made me view karma in a different way, which is, yes, there are certain things that we're born into this world carrying, whether it's genetic or biological or spiritual in the case of karma. And it's our opportunity here to level up. But there are always going to be limitations, right? So I guess that's the ultimate question, which is, how far can you push those limitations? You know, where is the boundary of that? Because the reality is there's certain things that I'm not going to be able to do in this life, right? Even when I was a child, when my parents told me, oh, you can do anything, that wasn't true, right? There were certain things that were holding me back. So anyway, it's a tricky one, but I like what you're saying with these stories, because it's easy for me to take these stories as a Westerner and kind of idealize Hinduism and Eastern religion and philosophy and say, oh, what a beautiful thing. But you're right that at this time they served a very specific purpose.
Yeah.
And that purpose was to keep people in their place.
The same way that the Bible was written at a period in time when they were trying to create agriculture.
Right.
This was written at a time when they were trying to stratify a society.
Mm-hmm. And they were successful.
Yes.
And we say they, I mean,
the Indo-Aryans of the Indus Valley.
So, I guess this is where I'm a little bit mixed up with the history here. So the people of the Indus Valley civilization, they were, would you say that they were semi-nomadic? Or
they were like a warrior.
But they weren't, they didn't, like you were saying earlier in the episode, they didn't write down a lot of this, what has become Hinduism. What was the word they used for it before, though? And a lot of Hindus use this word. It's starts with an S. It's Maya Santana. It refers, they don't refer to themselves as Hindus.
Mm.
They use another word, which is kind of this eternal truth or knowledge. But like you were saying, the people, the early Indus Valley people, they didn't write this down, right? It was just kind of
It was just passed down orally.
Right, right. Yeah. So then the Persians, the Indo-Aryans, came into the Indus Valley. I don't know what year this was.
Yeah.
And then they were responsible for what exactly?
Uniting small tribes, villages, building it was kind of at the start of the Bronze Age as well.
Right, yeah.
So kind of science, numbers, all of these things were sort of created during this period.
Okay. But then the what became Hinduism still was encouraged, supported, or at least maintained and written down at that time. And it became more part of...
And it traveled. So that was how it got here. So if you consider that India, and then they crossed over through sort of Thailand, Cambodia. Mm-hmm. So in Cambodia, you have the Angkor Wat temple complex, which has a lot of Hindu carvings. And then you see it like the later temples have more like Buddhist carvings. So Hinduism came first, traveled, and then made its way to Bali and also Indonesia. And following that was Buddhism, because Buddhism, which we will describe in our next episode, is kind of an offshoot of Hinduism, or like a progressive step from Hinduism.
Mm-hmm,
and then the Muslim religion, starting like 700 AD, that then came in and kind of washed over that area. And then brought all of Indonesia through the merchants and through the Silk Road. Changed to Islam, except for Bali.
I like this part of the story here. So, and Lawrence Blair, if you haven't listened to the Lawrence Blair episode, you should. We interviewed Lawrence Blair a couple of weeks ago, and it was awesome. He talks a little bit about this in his documentary, Ring of Fire. I think that's where I saw it. But, or maybe it was Miracle of Bali, the David Attenborough one. Either way, one of them, they're talking about what you're describing here, which is why did Bali maintain, because Bali's what, 90-something percent Hindu, whereas the rest of Indonesia is 90% something Muslim.
Yeah.
So why is that?
I think, so there's also parts like Borobudur and in Yogyakarta.
Mm-hmm.
So there's other parts of Indonesia where there are Hindu temples. But Bali, I think, held on to it for a number of reasons. There's a lot of myths that are rooted to this island.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the myth of the Mount Agung, the myth of Mount Meru, and this like washing of the ocean, and this whole world was created on a turtle's back, and Bali's like the center point of a lot of these myths happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just how closely tied people were to those stories. Possibly there's a lot of like landmarks on this island that they have myths for their creation.
So it became like a haven for Hindus, right? It became kind of the sanctuary.
It's hard to say. I think also it helps that it's like a little isolated island, whereas obviously Java and like is a much bigger island. I think also maybe the Banjar, because they have this Banjar system, the village council system that's so closely tied to the religion.
I don't know.
My dad was in Ambon visiting the Kei Islands, and they found a Hindu temple there.
Where is this?
In near Ambon. Like where's Ambon? Much further west in Indonesia.
Okay. So Sumatra area or?
No, Papua almost, I think.
Oh, east.
East.
Yeah, okay. East. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so it spread, and then there was a shift to Islam, which is a much more indoctrinating.
Yeah, yeah. It's more kind of like what we think of when we think religion. Yeah. And that's another interesting thing about Hinduism. But I think we're going to take a little break because the camera's probably turning off. We only got 30 minutes on the camera, so we got to turn it off and let the sensor cool down. But when we come back, let's talk more about this, kind of the difference between Hinduism and other religions, because there's no Mecca, there's no central figure in Hinduism, there's no claim to one truth, there's no Bible. They have the Vedas and lots of sacred texts, but there's no authority necessarily in Hinduism, which I think makes it unique. So we'll come back and we'll talk about that. Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah,
cool.
All right, so we're back.
Welcome back.
So, we wanted to touch off about like how Hinduism different from other religions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an important thing to talk about, because like we were saying before, there's no central figure in Hinduism. Mm-hmm. There's no central point of truth or authority. There's no Vatican-like place. There's no Mecca, which makes it very different than Islam or Christianity, because there's a certain hierarchy that goes along with that. There's a basically what Christians and Muslims believe is that they've got to go through someone else or something else to have a connection with God. And that's not really what Hindus believe. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, I think also Christianity and Hindu and Islam kind of give you a lot of rules mm-hmm. and tenets,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of goes against the central ethos of Hinduism, which is acceptance of everything mm-hmm. and unity between everything. But I mean, now things in India are changing a lot. We were just reading up a little bit about it. But like, for example, now in India, there's a number of states that have banned, they've banned the slaughter of cows and the transportation mm-hmm. of cows and the sale of cows. So now, but that's because there's a very right-wing government in power at the moment. So they're trying to kind of create these Hindu ideals, which actually Hindus and Muslims used to live harmoniously in that region for until the British left. You know, it was when the British left and drew Pakistan and Bangladesh and created these borders and made a lot of displacement in communities, was that when this conflict kind of really arose between the two religions.
So, and just so people know, so cows in Hindu belief, they're sacred. Mm-hmm. So Hindus do not eat cows.
Most Hindus in India are vegetarian, also mm-hmm. kind of stemming from that belief of karma. That you shouldn't like kill for your own self-indulgence. And
mm-hmm.
There's even like religions stemming from Hinduism, like Jainism, which take it even further. And they won't even eat root vegetables.
Really?
Because when you pull a root vegetable out from the ground, you're killing the plant.
Hmm.
So they'll only eat things that like hang off of trees.
Mm-hmm.
Because this idea of killing for your indulgence, can affect your karma.
Hmm.
And cows are sacred, I think, also in the essence that they live, like we drink cow milk in India, like cheese, milk, butter, all come from cows. Cows are used in the fields, like they give us so much. So there's this kind of element of they're sacred.
And mushrooms,
yeah. We wouldn't be able to live without them, so I think. And then there's also the association of Nandi, which is sacred cow, which is like the best friend of Lord Krishna, kind of.
Hmm.
He's a shepherd. So, there's a lot of association of the cow being sacred. And even in Bali, they don't really eat a lot. The Hindus won't eat beef, but they'll eat pork
mm-hmm.
pretty happily. So
yeah, the Babi Guling.
Apart from that, I don't know if there's a lot of rule, and I wouldn't even consider it a rule. Like in my grandparents' house growing up, like my grandma was a vegetarian, my grandpa ate chicken, my dad was eating beef growing up, going to, you know, Muslim restaurants and eating beef. So I don't know if it was so rigid as it is in Islam, where the pig is really like
you just don't do it. Mm-hmm. Like if you're a devout or even not so devout Muslim, you mm-hmm. do not eat pork.
Yeah,
and even your restaurant, shout out to Krishna's Kitchen. I don't know, do people know this, that you own an Indian restaurant? Have we ever talked about it before?
Yeah,
maybe like once or twice.
When we were starting the podcast and I was opening the restaurant.
Well, so Rishi has an awesome Indian restaurant, Krishna's Kitchen. Mm-hmm. Padang Padang. So if you're in Bali, in Uluwatu, check it out. It's really good. But just kind of by default, the menu is mostly vegetarian, right? That wasn't even really intentional. It's just a lot of the recipes that were passed on to you from your mother, grandmother, are just vegetarian by default.
Yeah, Indian food is primarily vegetarian. Meat mm-hmm. would be like a special occasion thing for most households.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to what you were saying about not the banning of the consumption of meat, but you're saying that they banned in certain states in India, they banned the slaughter and transport of beef,
mm-hmm.
which is essentially banning the consumption of it in some areas. So that's interesting to me because it's pointing towards something that's happening in a lot of different places in the world right now, which is regardless of the source of your religious conviction or your spiritual belief, that a lot of people, it seems, in the world right now are having this tendency to force their beliefs on others.
Fundamentalism.
Yeah. Which has always been the case throughout human history, but it seems we're in one of these phases right now where it's especially mm-hmm. acute, I guess you could say, or it's prevalent, mm-hmm. right? And that's interesting to hear because you don't often associate Hinduism with any kind of like nationalist right wing, right? Like authoritarian kind of movements or ideas. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is that there is this more kind of extreme, maybe extreme's a tough word, but...
Another way to also consider is that India as a country was only formed in 1947 right. when the British left. right. So a lot of those cultural, I think they're trying to create a national identity is what this government is trying to do. And kind of there's always been this conflict in the last 60, 70 years between the Muslims and the Hindus. And I think this government in particular is just trying to claim stake.
I see. Okay.
And try to make life for other communities who are not Hindu as uncomfortable as possible.
Really? Wow.
In some ways, yes. Huh.
Interesting. Yeah.
So there's been riots and there's been like floggings and there's been all kinds of like even people murdering people over the slaughter of cows going on now. It's creating divide, I would say, more than anything else. The purpose is to create a divide.
So there are other elements at play here. But at the core of it, it is from a religious belief
yes.
that cows are sacred.
An interpretation of a religious belief.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. Well, where do you want to take it from here? We've got a few more minutes. We try to keep our episodes a little shorter than an hour, but we can take it as long as we want.
I think I
want
to give a shout out to the Ramayana, which is right. another
yes, of course.
Really
yeah. yep.
important story and myth mm-hmm. in Hindu belief.
Yeah,
A lot of aspects of the Ramayana kind of also spill over into Bali. It's like a pretty important story. Mm-hmm. And this is the story, if anyone's wondering, there is an animated version on YouTube. Uh-huh. And it was like a Japanese-Indian collaboration to make an anime of the Ramayana. And it's really good. And I watched it as a kid growing up. And then I found it recently on YouTube again. It's excellent. Really ties in the story. But basically, it's the story of Ram, who's a god, whose wife gets taken or kidnapped and taken to current-day Sri Lanka by a villain god named Ravana. And this is the story of kind of good versus evil. And also the story of which... Hanuman, who's the monkey god, and his army of monkey army mm-hmm. help Ram bring Sita back. And this is kind of like one of the Indian epics. And it again shows this duality. Like Ravana is incredibly powerful. The dark forces are incredibly powerful. But in the end, there is this good element that overcomes. That story is also like translated in a lot of ways in Bali. Like Ravana has a female counterpart here called Rangda, who's like one of the scariest looking gods. She's got this like tongue that goes down and reaches the floor. And she's like a straggly witch. Uh-huh. And Hanuman is a really important character here, especially in Uluwatu where we stay. Like there's a lot of monkey worship, or not monkey worship, but like the monkeys are like pretty important to this part of town, and they're like allowed into the temples, and they're eating all the offerings, and they're kind of revered here. So
we kind of have to practical level, have to maybe not revere them, but appease them. Yeah, that's interesting. So getting to that good versus evil, and what we were talking about earlier with narrative being a very important part of Hindu tradition. So with the Ramayana specifically, what do you think that was trying to accomplish? Like what are they trying to communicate to people that would
like loyalty? So Ram has a brother called Lakshman and Hanuman is incredibly loyal to Ram. And there's this kind of element like Hanuman wouldn't exist without Ram and Ram wouldn't exist without Hanuman. And they're twice as powerful when they unify, you know, and this kind of aspect of loyalty, this, good overcoming evil, this duty. They also, like the two brothers, Ram and Lakshman, they go and study spiritual stuff and get kind of like superpowers. So there's like a lot of elements. It's an epic story. It's like even the animated version is like 2 hours long. But those are like main themes. Working together, so like to get to Sri Lanka, they build a bridge and they use like all the animals. There's this great song. in the animated version where like the turtles are like carrying stones and everyone's trying to work to build this bridge to Sri Lanka. Yeah, I think those are kind of the main themes.
So in here, I'm reading from the Ramayana Wikipedia page. It says the Ramayana belongs to the genre of Itihasa, narratives of past events, which include the Mahabharata, which we talked about, mm-hmm. the Puranas, and the Ramayana. The genre also includes teachings on the goals of human life. And that's kind of what I want to focus on, which is really all religion, all spiritual pursuits are trying to give people purpose and hope, you know, and mm-hmm. acknowledging this as the Hindus do, that there's some fucked up things that go on in this human existence. So how do you best deal with those? And I think that's what's kind of cool about Hinduism and about these narratives is that they deal with all these little intricacies and all these difficult things of being human. And they do them in a way that's entertaining too. I mean, I've heard that the Ramayana is, like you said, it's an epic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really fucking long, right?
Yeah.
But to that element of storytelling, right? That's like any good story is trying to communicate something to somebody, but also trying to get them to think a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the tricky part, but also the cool part of this, which is, okay, well, you have this story, may not be true, but we need something to hold on to,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, for the Christians, it's the Bible. You know, for Muslims, it's the Quran. We all need something to hold on to. And yeah, so I mean, you can talk more about the Ramayana, or we can just play this quote from, well, it's Alan Watts talking about Gandhi.
Yep.
And I think it gets to this larger point about religion
mm-hmm.
and about like what it is that we all want in this life. So you want to just play it and then we can kind of go from there and cap it off?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right. So this is Alan Watts, and this is, I need to give Being in the Way with Mark Watts, the podcast. This is where we're pulling this from. So, yeah. I think it's okay for us to use it, though, because, yeah, why not? It's just a short clip. So here it is. This is again, from the same show that we played a clip from earlier, which is Alan Watts talking about the Bhagavad Gita, but he's talking about Gandhi. So here we go. We'll just play this.
In 1925, Mahatma Gandhi wrote the following words. I find a solace in the Bhagavad Gita that I miss even in the Sermon on the Mount. When disappointment stares me in the face, and all alone I see not one ray of light, I go back to the Bhagavad Gita. I find a verse here and a verse there, and I immediately begin to smile in the midst of overwhelming tragedies. And my life has been full of external tragedies. And if they have left no visible, no indelible scar on me, I owe it all to the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita.
He gets to it, I promise.
The Bhagavad Gita was probably compiled about the 5th century B.C.
Maybe he doesn't get to it. Well, okay, so we'll cut him off there because that's a...
We covered that already.
We did cover that, but the reason I wanted to play that, well, first, yeah. That's kind of a different style of Alan Watts. He's like very slow and monotone in that, which you don't hear him a lot like that in that style. But what he says later on, I guess it was just a little bit... He took a while to get to that, so we'll just... We'll paraphrase, but he's talking about how interesting it is that Gandhi, of all people, Gandhi being a proponent of nonviolence, looks to the Bhagavad Gita. God, I can never say it properly. Bhagavad Gita.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's interesting that Gandhi feels that way about that text because it's about a war, like we described earlier, that even Gandhi with his nonviolence has this acceptance that sometimes things are violent. Sometimes things are destructive. And that's at the core of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that the best we can do is accept that. Right.
Yeah.
And the reason I wanted to play it is because I thought it was very, very telling and it kind of wraps it all up nicely, which is that's why humans engage in these spiritual and religious pursuits, is to give us some kind of hope in this craziness, mm-hmm. and give us, like we talked about earlier, just something to hold
on
to.
Some purpose,
because we all need that, right? Like these high-minded spiritual pursuits aren't really worth anything if you can't just get through the day-to-day life. And yeah, I thought that was kind of endearing, mm-hmm. to hear him talking about Gandhi and that Gandhi felt that way about it. Now it makes me want to read more of the Bhagavad Gita. It's like, whoa.
I have a short form version of it.
Do you?
I think so. All right, yeah.
Cool. Well, anything else you want to leave folks with? Maybe a little plug for the next episode. I know it's just...
I think Hinduism, our next one's about Buddhism. So yeah, we've chosen these three Eastern philosophies to focus on, mm-hmm. just to kind of contrast. I think a lot of people are really familiar with Western religion, and we just kind of want to give people an insight into Eastern religion because they give you a different way to think about things, a different way to view the world.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are very familiar with some of the concepts of Hinduism and Buddhism, but may not be aware of where they come from.
Yeah, and I think understanding that social context in which they came about.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And understanding that a lot of what we're seeing in the New Age spiritual community and New Age spiritual ideas and that whole world, a lot of it is being pulled from Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and a lot of this human optimization stuff. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You look at people like Aubrey Marcus, who I do not like. I think all of that is just, it's gone way out of hand. But a lot of it comes from these Eastern philosophies and religion. Mm-hmm. But in my opinion, some of those people are taking it and kind of tainting it and not really...
Well, I think a lot of them try to still, in the Western mindset, alleviate a lot of suffering, mm-hmm. and trying to teach you to up level and, but I don't know if the kind of concept of acceptance is.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think there's still a lot of those people are still looking at it through that Western mindset and saying, oh, well, I love this idea of elevation and expanding consciousness and this idea that I can do better and I can ascend and I can reach the state of enlightenment. But then they're missing the other side of it, which is what you said, the acceptance that Buddhism and Hinduism teach, which is, that's great that you can do that, but you still have limitations.
And suffering is a normal part of life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I look forward to learning more about Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So this week I'm going to do a deep dive and we'll come back with some more Alan Watts quotes probably, because mm-hmm. he talks the most about Zen Buddhism specifically and Taoism.
Yeah.
So next episode in this little series within a series will be about Buddhism, and then we're going to do Taoism, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So those three. And then after that, we'll probably get back to some counterculture stuff.
Yeah. I was thinking we could do an episode about death.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
because no matter what religion you are, you're going to die.
You're going to die, yeah. Yep, so deal with it. What was that book that you read?
Death.
It was called Death, and it was...
Sadhguru. I need to get it. I'll get it back from Daniela.
I love his name. Just that's how I always remember it. Just Sadhguru. Cool. So, well, thank you, Roosh.
Thanks for listening.
And thank you for all your insight as a cultural Hindu and as someone of Indian descent. I'm going to go eat some Indian food at your restaurant because I'm just this Indian kick right now and I'm starving. So let's do that. Yeah. Thank you for listening. And don't forget to, now I look at the camera. Don't forget to follow us, share the show if you like it. Check us out in Vias Media. We're up in our social media game finally after like a year of me talking about it. So we're going to do, what are we going to do? We're going to do an artist of the week now.
Yep.
Which
artist
is cool.
Artist of the week. Psychedelic artist of the week.
Yep. Psychedelic artist of the week. Who do we have coming up? Who's the...
Eugenia Lowley.
Yeah. Cool shit. Mm-hmm. Where's she from?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'll check it out. Well, you can check it out too. So we will see you next Friday.
Yep.
Because these episodes will come out every Friday. So we'll see you then.